Thank you.
Well, there are a lot of things that I could do. But at 5 o'clock, and 5 o'clock, by amongst the things I could do, one will be done. Let's just say we're going to christen a baby at 5 o'clock. The lecture, which we are about to embark upon, I hope will be of interest to people who are indifferently acquainted with Scientology, but will be of considerable assistance to people who are professionally practicing Scientology. This is a conference on nuclear radiation and health, but it would be impossible at this time to understand the ramifications of radiation without this brand new pair of data. There are two new bits of data which are of very great importance, and they amount to two scales, and one of them is called the reality scale and the other is called the effect scale. And these two scales, plotted against human behavior, make a tremendous difference in one's ability to understand the preclear or the person or a third dynamic activity such as radiation. Now, these two scales are very, very new. They are covered very comprehensively and exhaustively, and I hope not exhaustingly, in the 17th ACC lectures, which are being played at the HASI. But I would like to give you, if only a superficial, nevertheless, a comprehensive look at these two scales. As I say, we can't go into them with great depth and detail, but I can give you the salient points of them. First place, what is a scale? A scale is some type of measure. Basically, in Scientology, it's also something else, and that is a gradient. A gradient is simply a little bit more added to a little bit more until you get a whole range from a small amount to a large amount. That is a gradient. And the world operates on gradient scales. We go from a tiny bit of something into a large amount of something. We go from a large amount of something by gradients, gradually, step by step, down into a little bit of something. And there we have a gradient scale. Now, a scale in Scientology also means a measure of behavior at a certain level. So we have the basic scale of Scientology, the chart of human evaluation, which goes from a theoretical 1,000 down to, in Science of Survival, 0, and in 880 stretches on far south of that down to Hyde, which is about minus 8. Now, these are arbitrary numbers. They are completely arbitrary. The assignment of them, however, was originally done without attention to a datum which turned up later, and that is that these are harmonics. That is to say, when you double one of these numbers, you get into the same manifestation at a higher level. And when you double that number again, you get into a higher manifestation of the same sort. Just like a radio station puts out a signal at 570 kilocycles and is also heard at 1140. So you've just doubled its kilocycles, and although it didn't intend to broadcast at the higher level, it yet does, much to the embarrassment of many radio engineers. Now, this arbitrary scale, chart of human evaluation, was compiled from studies and data of a more or less mathematical nature to give us the reaction and behavior of human beings at various levels of aberration. As we go downscale on that, we descend into lower and lower levels of aberration, more and more complex levels of goofiness. And we find out that there was a consistency. People went this track. And when they were audited, they went back up this track. So the scale is more or less proven by the fact that a person, as he recovers from difficulties, goes into these upper brackets, so that you have a Scientologist saying, well, that fellow's a 1-5. Well, this is actually just Scientology jive talk to most people, but it is a highly technical statement. It means that a person is stuck at anger, and that his reactions are the reactions of anger. And on the chart of human evaluation, that gives us many, many columns of predicted behavior. It tells you what is wrong with him neurologically. It tells you what can be expected of him with regard to children. It tells you what can be expected of him with regard to communication. What will he do? And the only mistake we ever make with this chart is not believe it. Scientologists shouldn't be shocked because of their charitability. But someday, maybe, they are entirely too charitable. A good pattern, standard, straight out of a textbook, 1-1 walks in, and everybody says, well, it can't be that bad. And then they are terribly surprised to find out that under the column of treatment of children, this is what the fellow does. People do act this way. Right straight across the scale. So you have this level, 1.0 is fear. Just above fear, you get covert hostility. And there at 1.1, covert hostility, a person behaves in a certain way. Now when you audit him, he unfortunately goes up toward 1.5, so he gets mad at you. Well now, if the Scientologist didn't know that a person in covert hostility who is making nice remarks to you that cut you to the bone, he hopes. A very mild example of one-one-ism would be, oh, my dear, what a lovely hat. I have always thought so. This unknown would then make a Scientologist believe that he was really upsetting somebody simply because the person was getting mad. So he takes a 1-1, he audits him, the person gets mad at him. Aha. Scientologist then knows he's making the person better. That's an oddity, because otherwise he would look around and try to find some reason for the person getting mad. And it wouldn't matter what reason, the person would just get mad. First, I'll tell you he had reasons, but have you ever listened to the reasons of an angry man? They just don't exist. They are completely aberrated. So we take this 1-1, we audit him, he gets mad, and if we didn't have this chart of human evaluation, we would believe we were doing something wrong, we'd probably talk it over with him in some fashion to try to square away his anger and make him get unmad. Oh, no. What would we do if we did that? We would do what everyone has always done to him. Every time he started to get mad, they stamped on his head and says, go back to 1-1, you dog. They tried to put him back downstairs, you see. All right, so a Scientologist, knowing this, can bear with it. And up the fellow goes, if the Scientologist is doing a good job, and the fellow goes up here to 2.0, which is antagonism. Goes, well, all right, I'll accept your apology, which you haven't offered him. But I still think it was a very, very dirty trick, your moving your ear at that time. And from 2.0 and this antagonism, we finally find out, well, he knows what auditing's all about. He's not too interested in it now. He thought he was, but he really isn't. He goes to boredom. 2.5. Now we say, well, this person, if Scientologist didn't know this scale and follow it, he would say, you know, I've got to make this session more interesting because this fellow is getting bored. Well, the behavior of the Scientologist is raising a person up this scale. And it is not that he is boring the preacher. And this tells the Scientologist that he had better continue with the same process.
and get him up a little bit higher.
First time this was ever observed, by the way, was in running engrams. And if you run an engram, particularly on a wide open case, you'll find the person go straight up these bands from something like apathy, apathy to grief, to fear, to anger, to antagonism, to boredom, to conservatism, to enthusiasm, and then he relaxes and can be happy. And he goes straight on up the band, and running an engram or erasing a mental image picture caused him to change his tone in more or less the sequence. Sometimes we're fooled by this because there are harmonics of the tone scale at apathy. Apathy is all smashed in. And a fellow gets mad, gets sad, gets afraid, gets mad, gets sad, all in an apathetic tone of voice. You see, he's pulling up through these tiny gradients at apathy. And it's quite amusing to listen to apathetic anger. It is a very interesting emotion because he isn't going to do anything. It's how he could feel if he weren't feeling so apathetic. And we see this, and we audit thereby and do achieve a considerable amount of success. Now we're looking at this scale all over again. I merely want to point that out to you. We're now looking at this whole scale all over again, which goes from minus 8 right straight on through to about 10 or 12. And we're running people up the scale, again, by click, 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 click. Now, the funny part of it is there's another scale called the No to Mystery scale. That old scale is parallel of this other scale, but it's quite different. And when we're doing what we call opening procedure by duplication, which we call old book and bottle, you can actually watch a person go up this no to mystery scale. He goes from mystery right on up its various little grades and so forth. But it's a scale of significances rather than a scale of tone. And it's what he says about the object that establishes this scale. It's quite interesting that he will tell you the various steps of the scale, even if you get a green man, it has nothing to do, had never studied it, you'd run him on old book and bottle. Walk over to the book and pick it up and tell me the rest of it, and walk over to the bottle and pick it up and tell me something. Walk over to the book, walk over to the bottle, walk over to the book. Those aren't the commands, but that's the technique. And he comes right straight up this, and he comments on various things, and as he comments, you will see that his tone is going up this note of mystery scale. Well, similarly, today, in running CCH, we are running note of mystery, and we're also running, at the same time, simultaneously, this chart of human evaluations with its total sub-zero scale. The first thing that comes up is the sub-zero scale. We have some beautiful copies of those things, colored, that I was remarking on in the last lecture. They're very funny. They show a Phaeton in various stages from the bottom to the top. And a fellow runs this rather rapidly. You can watch these control processes run somebody out of the minus zero scale rather easily. Well, now the minus zero scale became important to us because it explained an interesting thing. It explained no memory. It explained amnesia and explained why people think they only live one life and a lot of other things that we had better not touch on in public. Because you see, a lot of man's behavior is so poorly regulated and so poorly thought out that he can't stand to hear about it. So we do the dodge of saying, well, that's all parascientology. And we don't talk to him about it in public, that's all, because it's something he, well, he sort of keeps it in the dirty clothes hamper, you know. And he doesn't want to have it called to mind. After all, he's a respectable greengrocer now. But the reason why he forgets these things, and the reason why he lays aside his abilities and his irresponsibilities, lies in this minus zero scale. He goes as a being below death. His body is alive, but he's below death. And when you graduate him up scale, he can think a hostile thought like killing something. But also, he has his memory buried, his experiences and his ability are all laid aside. He considers himself at such a low level that he has no memory, no ability, nothing. So it's very interesting to get him out of this morass because he starts remembering things that he probably shouldn't, such as why he had to marry the girl in the last life and
and other things, you know, embarrassing.
We've, as a matter of fact, run down half a dozen murders. After Bridie Murphy, some hypnotist reading Dianetics, went over and audited somebody in a hypnotic fashion and found a past life. And he was so ecstatic about this that he just thought this was wonderful, you know. He just drooled. The darn fool went out and tried to find this Bridie Murphy. Well, I think he found her all right. He should have. He must have been stone blind if he didn't. And the person had lived before, and her name was Bridie Murphy. Well, here we go. Over here, with a great deal of ecstasy, a newspaper editor says, "Ooh, oh my, well, let's run some big stories on this. And let's find a lot of these and find out whether or not there's any more of them." And one of our very able Scientologists, Dr. Kemp, went down and told him my suggestion. "Please, please lay off. You will find very rapidly that the trouble is not finding past, getting people into past lives, but getting people out of them." And there are so many of these lying around that you're going to be embarrassed. And sure enough, within a couple, 3 days, the editor had run up the white flag, had called Ray and had said, you're right. And he didn't publish very much about it. There were just too many people writing in, phoning in, "Yes, I used to be Julius Caesar, you know." We have a new joke in Scientology, you know, in the head shrinking business. The trick cyclist has an interesting viewpoint. The gag is a fellow standing in the cell, you know, like this, and the guard says, "You know, he's crazy." "Oh, he is," Brewster said. "Yeah, he thinks he's Napoleon." "I am." In Scientology, it sometimes gets to be a contest amongst your prequels, fortunately not amongst Scientologists. He thinks he's Julius Caesar, but he's wrong. "I am." It's quite amazing, the activities, behavior, sins, and randomities of the human spirit. These things are quite easy to plot, trace. We know about them in Scientology, and we never mention them in public. And this is not in public. We're amongst friends. The point is that certain data exists, and if it exists and you ignore it, why, you have difficulties. Because why? Because you're going on the roundabout of a lie. When you're running people up the minus tone scale, you're running them up toward death, which is a lot of recollection compared to where they are. See, they're so low down they wouldn't even kill anything. You want to get them so high up they don't have to. In between, they may be a social liability. Now, here we have, then, this view of a person unwinding up the scale, getting higher and higher, as himself, as a spirit, as a being, as a song. You know, there are three parts of man. There's the body, there's the mind, and the spirit. Now, some of us argue about this spirit until we put it this way. We say to the group, we say, "You got a body, don't you?" And the people say, "Well, I don't know. I'm haunted. I would like it." Well, they find they have a body. You agree they have a body. Then take them up old Dianetic style and show them some mental image pictures, you know. Show them some of their sins on the back track. And they say, "Well, what's all this? What's these mental image pictures and other phenomena that I see when I close my eyes? Just like you all saw an elephant last night." That was a mock-up elephant you saw, which is a perfectly good elephant. Well, we were calling for another kind.
people.
Look at this, and you say, uh-huh.
Now that is the mind.
And they say, well, I'm getting real smart.
Parts of man,
body.
That's right.
Mind.
No, you're right. There are two parts of man.
But this thing's spirit. We can talk about spirit.
You say, well, let's not worry about spirit.
But you tell me what felt the body and looked at the mind.
They say, well, I don't know what did that.
We say, you did that. Felt the body, looked at the mind. Something felt the body.
Now, a scientist these days got this all taped. You see, a machine runs a machine which looks back at the first machine and then has another machine to tell it that it looked. And this adds up to a fourth machine which is known as the id. I don't buy that because it seems to breed machinery. There's just more and more machinery comes into the picture and no actual beingness is ever announced. Well, we just get tired of moving back through the rows of machinery. So we say to the fellow, what looked at the mind and felt the body? What felt the body and looked at the mind? What's going on here? Then we say, now, from that point on, we don't care what you call it. If you say it is a spirit, all right. If you say it's a soul, all right. If you say it's a ghost, all right, maybe. If you say it's a demon, you're probably absolutely right. But whatever it was that did this, that is what we mean by a thetan. And a thetan is a mathematical symbol which means thought in Greek. And that's all thetan is. It's a mathematical symbol. And you write it with the symbol theta. And that's because we represent this phenomenon with an abstract, you see? Rather than get into a bunch of arguments. Not that we don't mind, not that we dislike arguments, but we like to be understood. We have a peculiarity. We're peculiar people. Most people say they're misunderstood. And so forth, and they probably are, and we are the best understood people in the world. Most people go around afraid that they will be completely understood. That's why you have trouble auditing them. So they flinch back against all of this data, but eventually they come around to it and they say, let's see, something felt the body, something looked at the mind, and that something is what you are talking about. Now, if you blow them out of their heads, you do something else with them, gives them a greater subjective reality, they say, "Wee, what do you know? I am not a mind, I am not a body," but that's secondary. That's, as they go up scale, get auditing, they have these various experiences. Well, we're not interested at the basic, fundamental level of that. We are interested in the behavior of this mind, which is a sort of a bridge between the beingness, the thetan, and the body. Now, the body could not possibly be on the minus scale. Why? By definition, it would be dead. But what is this beingness that can be deader than dead? Well, that's merely an observed phenomenon concerning a thetan. He can exist below the level of body death. And if you think a body is remembering anything when it's lying there in the casket, look again. It doesn't remember the thing. But it's still holding its shape and form somehow. And so is a thetan on the minus scale. He is holding his shape and form, which he has none of, on a fixed series of postulates that now he's supposed to be this way and act this way and react this way. All right, now if we understand that clearly, we understand that he is at an almost uncommunicable level. Just as bodies don't respond when we tap them, Satans don't whistle when we beckon. They're deader than bodies. And that's an interesting thing. They're below memory, below analytical action and reaction. In many cases, they are dependent entirely upon the amount of energy they can pour into some kind of body machinery which somehow or other runs them. Now, any Scientologist has subjective experience on this. They know we're talking straight along. The only reason I'm reviewing this rapidly is to bring out to you the scale of reality viewed from the standpoint of a Thetan. The scale of reality goes down well in to the minus zero scale. And the way we can plot that today reaches into the minus zero scale because we are going below terminal with the scale of reality. Now, what do we mean by a terminal? Well, a scientific, psychological explanation of a terminal is a complex one, so let's give a careless one here. Let's just say a terminal is a mass which can be communicated to or which can communicate. It's a mass, best way to think of it. And you know these people below that level can no longer really observe a mass. But there is something they can observe below mass. They can observe a line, a communication line. They can no longer see the person, but they can get a reality on the line between two persons, even though they do not see either person. It's very interesting that we have a process that turns this on, not a particularly good process, but an experimental one. We have somebody look around the room and find something that could make an effect on something else. If he does that for a while, some lines start showing up. Just all kinds of lines, black lines or gold lines or something like that. These things will show up through the room. Interesting phenomena. You're turning on the lines I am talking about. He has a greater reality on a line than he does a terminal. In other words, we have Western Union or Atlantic cables or the post office telegraph system. The people on that are much more apt to think of lines than they are stations. They think of the wires and so forth. They haven't any great reality on the terminals to which they're talking and a greater reality on the lines over which they are talking. The telephone line is more an actuality to them than the telephone or the person on the end of it. All right. Knowing this, we get not the lowest reality point, but we get an entrance point, because just below it, there is neither a line nor a terminal in the estimation of this thing we call faith. We have neither one, a line or terminal. But the line shows up before the terminal shows up. And to get a person to see his body, it is necessary to first permit him to see a line. And this is a very, very useful discovery, which I made here some months ago. Very useful. Because it takes this fellow on this minus zero scale, and it beckons him toward reality. Now, you know that people who are bad off do not keep their word. They make an agreement with you, and they do not keep it. They sometimes mistake you for another, or don't even know you're there. And as high as they would go ordinarily would be to get hung up on a line someplace. They sometimes think of themselves as messages. Quite interesting. Particles on a line. All right. Now, what would reach such a person in terms of reality? He has neither terminals nor lines. The first thing that we join with on the scale of reality is line. And how do we do that? With a hand. The hands start to get real to people right in here. And then they start to get realer and realer and realer. This doesn't mean they're terribly low tone when this happens to somebody. Because you have, when you have effective techniques, you cease to be worried about people who are low tone. And all of a sudden he gets more and more, more and more.
One more.
See, he has somebody, he shakes hands. And a reality occurs right here. Shakes hands some more. You get more arms. Shakes hands some more. You got more and more arms. And all of a sudden, he says, there's Joe. You get the idea? By, he had neither lines nor terminals. Now you give him a line, and then he gets a terminal. And this is fascinating. Because it leads upstairs to tolerance of masses. So the first reality, if you can call it that, on a Thetan, on the sub-zero scale, is no lines, no terminals. You exteriorize him and he doesn't have a room. You say, get out of your head, and he gets out of his head, and you say, look around, and he says, yes, I see the hospital. But he's not in a hospital, he's in an auditing room, see? Now, there is why his reality is poor. He cannot tolerate the objects or lines in the room, and he cannot tolerate looking straight at you, the auditor, and so he therefore has this difficulty. Now, how do we graduate him out of this? Very simply, he starts in without lines or terminals. We therefore give him lines, and he eventually gets terminals. And when he's got terminals, he can get then agreements. And when he can get agreements, he can then get postulates. And between agreement and postulate is that special kind of agreement known, or special kind of a postulate known as a continuing postulate, caused by us a consideration. All right, there is the scale of reality. It starts at the top of the postulate, goes down into a continuing postulate, a consideration, into that special continuing postulate called an agreement, down into that special thing called a mass, down into terminal, down into no line, no terminal. And when you walk a person's reality upstairs with communication, it can then and therefore follow this track and should follow this track. And it goes from no terminals, no lines, nothing, up to lines, up to terminals, up to agreements. We're trying to run somebody's postulates and agreements out when they can't even find a line. That tells you why we've been missing up occasionally with a pre-clear, you know? We're trying to try to run somebody's agreements out. We know what's wrong with him. He agreed to be sick. He can't find the line, so we're going to undo the agreement? Oh, no, we're not. You're going to have to get the line, reality of. Then the terminal, reality of. Then the agreements appear very real. And then the continuing postulates, the considerations, appear real. And only then do you get him up to a point where he can undo or redo his postulates on his own decision. You know, you can always get somebody to redo his postulates. You just change them around for him, but you can always do that. But he now has the power to postulate. And woe betide the enemies this person has, because if this postulatingness continued on down scale below the level where it actually lives, it'd just be the saddest, sorriest world you ever heard of if people at 1-5 could postulate and they could stick. And they can't. Or if people at Boydham could make their postulate stick. They can't. They can make their postulate stick only above the point where they always keep a bargain. Isn't that an interesting commentary on man? Mm-hmm. To make a postulate stick, it almost lays down this is moralizing on what is only a scientific technical scale. If a person could make a postulate stick every time, or change a postulate at will, which we know is the best therapy there is, he would also always keep all of his agreements in all directions, or could undo them when they were concluded. And he would also be able to conceive and behold masses of any and all kinds, and he would also be totally cognizant of any and all lines at will, and he would also be totally cognizant of periods of nothingness over which he still had control. In other words, he'd have the whole of the reality scale in his grasp. I'll go over it again. It starts at the top of the postulate, then a continuing postulate, and then below continuing postulate comes agreement. And we're now moving into the finite band, the 4.0 on down, when we say the reality of an object. those people normally have from 4.0 down, their greatest reality is that objects are and lines are. And we move from there down to about 2.0, and here we fade on down with a line and less object, you see, less and less objects over here, and more line, until we get into the minus tone scale, and there we have lines. Where's a rope so I can hang myself, you know? And then this goes on down to just nothing. And that is the reality scale. And it tells us at once that someone at the level of 0.1, you know, apathy, body apathy, comes around. He says, you know, I've just made a postulate, and the entire government is going to revolt tomorrow. Don't you believe it? That person's postulates don't stick. They get frantic about them, and they try to tell you they do, but they don't. It's quite interesting, quite a fascinating view. It's as though life had its own brakes, its own inhibitions, and it safeguarded its abilities, so that as a person loses these abilities and takes on other attributes, he is fortunate to have lost the abilities from the viewpoint of the rest of us. In other words, an individual had at 1.5, sure as the dickens, better not have the ability to postulate cleanly and clearly, or people will start dropping dead all over the place. But the way it's rigged, and these things are just basically considerations and agreements amongst the race, the way it's rigged is, by the time he gets down to that point, he couldn't keep a contract. You know, there are some people that if you sign an airtight contract with them, perfect contract that was highly beneficial to them in all directions, you would then and thereafter find yourself at once in court. A lot of people go around saying, well, it's all right if I have it on a contract. Oh, no, it isn't. Not in this day and age. It's all right with the people it would be all right to contract with. You don't have to contract anything. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you really never need it in writing with a fellow that you should be doing business with. Quite amazing, you know. You say, Joe, why don't I let you have 100,000 of these so forth, and you can pay me next Tuesday at 3.1 pence. Hey, he says, okay, all right. Oh, my goodness, books get delivered, and there's tremendous sums of money involved and all the rest. You need patience, I'm sorry. But this other fellow, you say, well, I don't trust him too well, so the thing for me to do is to make it all out in a big contract. So you go get a firm of solicitors, and they hire another firm for consultation, and they all sit around the table, and they go down your thoughts, and their thoughts, it's all going to be adjudicated in court, and we write it all down, and it's put into very legal language, and then somebody is paid. I think they pay them a sixpence for every extra whereas that they throw in. And we get it all done, and we seal it, and we bond it, and we put it in a vault, and the books still don't get delivered or paid for, whichever one you were standing on. See? Contract doesn't make any difference. In other words, if you have to sign a contract, you're in much better shape not to do business. Businessmen learn this the hard way, and usually with their business associates, a fellow who is really successful in business, with his business associates, he has certain people that he will do business with easily. And it's just a matter of picking up the phone and saying, hey, Joe, how about 320 quid till Tuesday? I'll give you a note on it if it comes to mind. And the fellow puts it in your bank, you know. You say, well, it's against this next shipment. He doesn't say, well, are you going to deliver it? Is it in good shape? He says, well, when we have next shipment? He says, well, I'll have that by Wednesday. And you say, okay. That's the way about 99% of the business of the world is done. Much to the disgust of solicitors, because they get a lot of money trying things in court. You see this? Yeah. All right, all sorts of social considerations derive from this reality scale. What is real to a person? that which is real to a person, he respects. That which is to a person, is. And a person who is below the level of agreement does not consider that an agreement ever exists, even when it is in writing. And a person who is below the level of terminal doesn't believe you exist even when you're poking them the jaw. And a person who is below the level of lying doesn't do a thing when he shakes hands with you. He just doesn't do anything. He has not done anything. You say, Jones meet Dow. He didn't even wakes up to a point of saying, who is that I just met? Of course he doesn't. He might get up to a point of wondering whether or not he had shaken hands with anyone in the last half hour. See, but that would be a high-toned reality for him. They got this thing taped because it's something that needed pretty well, it needed elucidation in Scientology, because we talk a lot about postulates and terminals and communication lines and that sort of thing, but where do they peg on the tone scale, and what is the expected behavior regarding them, and how do people react toward these things? Well, that is the reality scale. Now, right alongside of the reality scale is the scale of effects. And this one tells you whether auditing is auditing or just tomfoolery. It actually is not too intimately connected with the reality scale, but the two influence each other, just as they both influence the ARC, Chart of Human Evaluation. Now, what is this scale of effects? Well, stand by for a great big piece of understanding of the human race. When this one fell out of the hamper, I said, oh, no. I said, radiation, here we come. This is it. This tells you the dwindling spiral. It's the scale of effects. Now, as I've been talking to you about the Chart of Human Evaluation, you might have envisioned a great many scales here, a great many lines, and a person would go downscale as he got more and more plugged in and less able to mote. And we could plot the reality scale alongside of that, and the scale of effects can also be plotted on the same type of gradient. But it tells you something entirely different. Not what is real to the person. It tells you the acceptable effect. What is an acceptable effect? Boy, right in this one, Boddicher, all of a sudden when he grabs this one, he says, ah. He said, that's why I've never been able to crack Jojo the dog-faced boy's case. That's why. No. Horrible. Now listen. If you look in Scientology, the fundamentals of thought, you'll find there a description of the game's conditions. The more plunged in a fellow gets on an aberrated game's condition, an unknowing game's condition, the more he goes toward no effect on self, total effect on something else. The closer and more closely approaches this. You got that now? That condition sets in more and more as the person goes down this scale. Less and less effect on self, greater and greater effect on somebody or something else. So, we have two columns on this effect scale, and one is effect on others, and that starts at the bottom, just tremendous, big, a person way down on the minus zero scale, his idea of a mild effect on somebody else would be to have four double-barrel shotguns rigged up at once, each one pointing at the person's midriff. Give the person a half a gallon of strychnine and fire the guns at the same time. And he says, that's just about what we should do for people. But then he'd have a pause on the thing and he'd say, now just a moment. They might survive it. Maybe if we put an electronic field around them so they couldn't get out of that, at the same time we fired all the guns, and we've got head shrinking. Now, that's lower down on this, that isn't the bottom, but that's low down on this effect on others scale. And that, as it goes upscale, the acceptable effect on somebody else is lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter until it's not necessary. All right. No effect on self. So let's look at the effect on self scale, which parallels this, and we get down at the bottom. Acceptable effect on self is theoretically at the bottom at zero, and then moves up from no effect on self of any kind to greater and greater tolerable effect. I can stand greater and greater effects, greater and greater effects, greater and greater effects, until we get up to the top. We have a person at the top of this scale. If you took four double barrel shotguns and gave him a gallon of strychnine and fired the guns off and surrounded him with an electronic field, he would say, "Whee." You got it? Well, there's where he'd be on the upper scale. In other words, what we thought about in mysticism and in other places and have spotted, the inability to get ruined, sometimes considered to be granted by one, by some strange god someplace or another. You know, God's on my side, so I can't get my ready head blown off. They played that game almost out in 1914. They just, you went over the top this way and you saw Gott mit uns, and you went over the top the other way and you saw God's with us, and everybody after a while said, "You know, I don't think he's around." And there went an awful lot of faith and decency in the world. Just like that. Misusing a tone 40 for some sordid political end didn't work. So a person feels that this is granted to him or something of this sort, then he'll survive it somehow or another. He'll get through with it. Well, regardless of that, there actually is such a point. There actually is such a point where a person's beingness can be sufficiently great that he becomes practically indestructible. It's a theoretical point, but he is able to tolerate tremendous effects on self to the degree that he is satisfied with little tiny effects on others. Isn't that interesting? Up here, he could stand a tremendous effect on self, but doesn't have to have one, and would be perfectly satisfied with a little tiny insignificant effect on somebody else. It would be very gratifying. He walks down the street, he looks at somebody as he passes, and that person glances back. You say, "Boy, this isn't much of an effect." Well, that's a totally satisfactory effect. I'm a little lower scale than that. I walk down the street, I smile at somebody, and I sometimes feel something is wrong if they don't smile back. But this is a terrific enough effect. See? This is big effect. All right, they smile, making people smile. Will and so forth. That's a perfectly satisfactory effect to be able to cause. That's up here somewhere. You're more or less in that, consideration level. You don't have to kill somebody to know that something happened to him. But look, as we get less and less effect on self, as we get less and less effect on self permissible, we get less and less possibility of finding out there'd been an effect on the other fellow. Ooh, look at this. Look at this at the bottom. If it's no effect on self, we could blow somebody up, mop them up, soup them up, kill them, maim them, burn them, and keep them in that order and condition for the rest of eternity, and we would never find out about it. You got that? So your person would never find out if he had rendered an effect on somebody else. You got it? All right, in view of the fact that he'd never find this out, we get the dwindling spiral. Because he tries harder and harder and harder to create these terrific effects. And he never is satisfied because he doesn't know they ever landed. So he just tries harder and harder and strikes tougher and tougher. No more and less effect is tolerable on self until at last
he gets caught up totally in the overt act motivator sequence.
He commits these terrific effects and becomes the center of them.
And we don't start the cycle all over again. He just spins on in from there on. You got that?
What do you think the basic philosophy is behind a man who would have to kill off
the whole world with radiation in order to know he had done something? What is his state of case? But the funny part of it is they go down the effect on self scale, they actually become more and more easily manipulated. Now, listen, I didn't say anything about it. Now, I didn't say that you were supposed to go find this guy and simply lead him around by the ear. All I said was, don't be scared of it, because you could. Somewhere down in this range, he is in total hypnotic report with anything that addresses him. He's resisted effects so hard that he becomes anything that confronts him and never finds out about it. And there is the range of your, quote, unsolvable case. A lot of people go around and they have to make these tremendous effects. This is particularly true of some newspaper reporter, something like that, some young chap. He turns in this tremendous story, you know. 8 fire engines came down into Trafalgar Square and they all hit head on and crushed half the police force amongst them. This is the sort of a story that he just hopes that he can come up with, you know. Because this means name on the front page. This is success. Never can he understand. He just cannot understand why it is that ever so often on the front page some feature writer writes a story about a dog is lost. A dog named Patsy was lost at Union Station, was apprehended by the police for sniffing. He can't understand how anybody would ever read this story. He read it and appreciated it. He can't understand how it got on the front page, because he knows what should be on the front page. What William Randolph Hearst and the early British publishers of scarehead tabloids and so forth. Do you know every one of those papers has more or less failed in the United States? And they still try it. The old conservative papers that put a few advertisements on the front page, and the fact that the prime minister was assassinated in the last page under police notices, are still going on. Those papers still continue. The scarehead ones don't. They really don't even believe that the public has to be told things this violently to receive them. They don't believe you have to say things like that to sell papers. As a matter of fact, it doesn't sell papers. That's what's so peculiar. But it is the obsession on the part of the editor and publisher that he must create this tremendous effect. The only terms in which he can think are, boy, we haven't got a story for the main edition tonight. I wish half the world would fall off from the other half. That would be a good lead. But as he drives his audience with these effects, one after the other, what does he finally come up against? He comes up against a saturation point. It isn't that the audience wants bigger and bigger and bigger effects. That's the wrong way to look. That's the way they look from the effect on self over to the effect on others scale. The truth of the matter is people, human beings, thetans, can tolerate less and less and less and less and less. So someday a newspaper comes forward and publishes a whisper and is a tremendous success. The young writer always goes up against this. He thinks the great novel has got to roar. As you open the cover,
a bomb goes off.
It's a very funny thing. I wrote never used to write detective stories at all to amount to anything. But every once in a while, some friend of mine would tear in, have to have a detective story or something of the sort, and I'd write one. But I always balked at writing detective stories as detective stories, so I used to take all the taboos in detective story parlance and patterns and write the exact reverse of the taboo, knowing then that I had a wide open field. I knew then it was original. And one publisher of a very famous detective magazine that used to sell some horrendous numbers of copies unfortunately issued a whole list of taboos, stories he would not accept under any condition. He wouldn't accept a story without tremendous action in it. He wouldn't accept a story without a good villain. Well, that was a setup. So the first one was very simple to answer that request. I just wrote a story about the sergeant and the detective with spring fever, and they sat with their feet on the desk and waited for a watch to run down. And at the end of the story, because the watch had run down at a certain hour, they went and arrested the murderer, but you didn't even attend their arrest. A story must have action. Now, it's just no action, no motion. He bought it. He couldn't help it. It just went right straight through. The second story, that a story must have a good villain, a rough villain, a tough villain. The murderer was a Pekingese. This was my peculiar method of making nothing out of detective story writers that I think are rather humorous. But anyhow, all of these tremendous effects of one kind or another lead up to this, that the person, if you could get a publisher to publish it, if it ever could get onto a newsstand, you would find tremendous sales in a very unknowing games condition society for a book that started out with, quote, yarn, unquote. It was a nice day. All the other books are starting out, bang, bang, three men fell dead. They don't sell. People don't want to read them. People just publish them. I used to write a great deal for the Washington Herald, feature stories. And it was rather a puzzle to me. This fellow, his name was Mike Flynn, since dead. He was the editor of that paper. I was going to university at the time. I used to wander around town every once in a while with a camera or something like that and write a feature story, and he'd pay me a few bucks. It was quite amusing, one way of getting through college, so you didn't have to attend class. Anyway, every once in a while, I'd notice these things on the front page, and the stories which I, at that time, didn't think should ever have gone near the front page were very wisely put there by Mr. Flynn. And the stories which I was sure were banner headlines always appeared under obituaries. I just had it completely backwards. I thought you had to make a big effect to make the front page, just like everybody else in Hearst's organization thought. And a tiny effect should go between. I wrote a story one time about a streetcar rails were being torn up and wrote their history. And they started out with a horse car. So I wrote the history of the horse car, made the front page. Never could understand why I received 283 letters in response to that silly story. Incomprehensible. If you'd covered the death of the president, you wouldn't have gotten one. So here's this backwards thing. Now, I'm not saying that an auditor here and there is trying to make a tremendous effect to find out if he's audited the preclear. That would be a critical, meaningless statement because it isn't true. But it is true that the preclear starts to get well when you find a tiny enough effect that he can accept. And therefore, a regular, smooth technique, which doesn't particularly shake him up, that will permit him to find that an effect is at last acceptable to him will bring him right on up tone scale. And those are the control processes and why they work. They are such a tiny effect that a person can accept them. We've been trying to go for broke on these cases that resisted everything when we should have been trying to find the small enough section of ascent, the effect that they can really receive and know they've received it and admit they've received it, is so infinitesimally small that we as auditors will have to do an awful lot of mopping around to discover it. And that is modern auditing. And that's most mainly because we have the reality scale and the effect scale. And you'll find both of them very useful, and I'm very glad to have found them for you. Thank you.